want to say a few words? Okay. Who's our president, Jonathan Blank. Thank you for that wonderful introduction. I'm the man who needs none. On behalf of the show, I'd like to welcome all of our members and guests to this first of a monthly lecture series by Rabbi Breidowitz. The next lecture in this series will be approximately 5 weeks from now. We haven't decided the exact date, but the topic will be reproductive technologies and family planning. And announcements as to the exact date and time will be posted as soon as we can determine on a date that has no conflicts with the rest of the community. It is a great pleasure for us to welcome all of you to hear Rabbi Breidowitz. Following the lecture, there will be refreshments served in the Beis Medrash. All of you are welcome to join us. Thank you. I just want to second our president's welcome and welcome all the newcomers to our synagogue. And we hope that you'll continue to participate in our Limud HaTorah together. I'll talk for a while, and then after I talk, I'll certainly throw the floor open to any questions or comments or disagreements or corrections that you may have. The question is very often raised, particularly among people outside of the Orthodox community, why are Orthodox people not ethical in business? And there are really two responses to that question. First of all, empirically, that's not necessarily so. You know, obviously, in any group of people, you have good people and bad people. One cannot make it, I think it's defamatory to say that we have a higher proportion of people who are unethical than anyone else. But I think there's a more fundamental answer. And the answer is to ask a question, to pose a dichotomy, why are Orthodox people not ethical in business is what we call an oxymoron. It's a nonsensical statement, because it makes no difference if you put on tefillin, eat glatt kosher meat, and keep Shabbos. If you're not ethical in business, you are not a Torah-observant Jew. There is no such thing as an Orthodox Jew who is not ethical in business. The Torah itself contains the mitzvos, not only between man and God, but also the mitzvos between man and man, human relationships. One is at least as important as the other. And if one says, the Gemara tells us, mitzvah zanah, this commandment is proper to keep, and this commandment is not proper to keep, that is what we call heresy. That is apikorsis. So the answer to the question is, why are Orthodox Jews not ethical in business? The answer is, if you're Orthodox, you have to be ethical in business. The Gemara in Shabbos tells us, in fact, that when a person leaves this world, God asks the soul a number of questions. And the very first question that one gets in the hereafter is Nasasa v'nasata b'yamuna. Did you conduct your business affairs with honesty? That is the first question. The second question is, did you learn Torah on a regular basis? But the very first question is, how did one conduct his affairs in relationships in the business world? And the truth of the matter is that although the issues we'll be talking about tonight are fairly mundane, they are not as dramatic as the ethical conflicts in the medical ethical area, which I've also talked about on occasion. We're not dealing with life support systems. We're not dealing with abortions for comatose mothers. The issues are not dramatic. We're dealing with mundane issues. What do you have to do when you sell your car? How do you take out a loan? How do you advertise? They're mundane, but they're issues that all of us face every single day of our lives. And it's been well said many times that although sometimes a Jew is called upon to give up his life for the Torah, and it's hard to give up your life, it is much harder to live as a Jew than it is to die as a Jew. Because the act of martyrdom, the dramatic act of self-sacrifice, is something that is over in an instant. But the very difficulties of living your life step by step and involving yourselves in the mundane trivialities of your life and trying to conduct them in accordance with a higher morality are considerably more difficult than the drama of throwing yourself, as it were, on the funeral pyre to give up to make the supreme sacrifice. And indeed, if you look at the Yom Kippur davening, where we spend the whole day beating our breasts and reciting the commission over every possible sin known to man, at the very end of Yom Kippur, there is a short Shmoneh Esrei. This is the Shmoneh Esrei of Ne'ilah. It's the final prayer of the day. And we're trying to sum up the direction that we want our lives to go. And we no longer recite the lengthy Al-Khayt. If you remember, Ma'ariv and Shachris and Musaf and Mincha, we have a long litany of the Al-Khayt Shechatanu Lefanecha. But by Ne'ilah, we don't say that anymore. We only talk about one sin. And if you look in Shemone Esrei, the one sin that we talk about is theft, is depriving other people of what is rightfully theirs. And even the generation of the flood, we are told, in spite of all their horrendous sins, the Gezar Din, the final judgment of the Dor HaMabul, was decided because of theft, because of the way they treated other people's money and other people's possessions. The Gemara in Erechin tells us that a minority of people are guilty of the various sexual improprieties in the Torah. Most people at some time or another are guilty of theft, and all people in their lives are guilty of the sin of Lashon Hara, which is making derogatory statements about other people. Now it's interesting that as we discuss the ethical issues in the business world, we will find that the two predominant halachic areas are areas of theft and areas of Lashon Hara, of derogatory statements made against other people. And let me say at the outset that the notion of theft does not refer to the crude notion of breaking and entering or armed robbery. Nobody, you know, most people don't commit armed robbery, but theft can take many forms. Theft can take forms of false advertising, getting somebody's business through misrepresentation or failure to correct a misapprehension that the person has. Theft can constitute borrowing something without permission. Theft can constitute cheating on a test. Theft can even constitute waking somebody from a nap or playing your stereo late at night, because that is considered to be theft of sleep, which is indeed a fairly serious form of theft. And to some extent, as we know, as all of us know, who are parents at least, lost sleep cannot be made up. And to some extent, theft of sleep is even more serious than theft of property, which can be made up. I thought here that what I'll be talking about tonight are not acts of piety. They're not acts of going beyond the law. We all know that in Jewish law, there is a concept of the minimum requirements of the law. There's the letter of the law. And then there is a notion that a Jew is supposed to go beyond the letter of the law. A Jew is supposed to go beyond the letter and follow the spirit of the law. But I'm not going to talk about the spirit of the law. I'm going to talk about the law. And when we have a sense of how demanding the law is, we will certainly see that there's so much we can aspire to just to fulfill the din, and then we have the higher levels of going beyond the din. I also run the risk tonight of either being oversimplistic to those who are fairly knowledgeable and over-technical to those who perhaps are not as familiar with the subject matter, and it's very hard to steer a middle course, but I hope that each audience will tolerate the degree of oversimplicity or over-technicality that I may force that I may be forced to engage in. I thought a helpful way of looking at the whole matter would be to divide the ethical problems that we face in professional life vis-a-vis four groups of people. What are our responsibilities towards our competitors? Two, what are our responsibilities towards our customers, whether we sell goods or services, if we're lawyers or doctors or the like? Three, our responsibilities towards our colleagues and employees. And four, our responsibilities towards the government and the legal system as a whole. First, let's focus a bit on our relationship towards our competitors. First of all, on its face, that's a fairly strange notion. To pose the question, what responsibility do I have towards my competitor, seems a bit foreign to the American psyche. After all, competition is the basic foundation of capitalism. Each person out for himself. We have the Darwinian notion of a survival of the fittest. It's a cutthroat world out there, and if you can't make it, that's the way the system is supposed to work. And yet we do find that the halakha requires that I assume a certain sense of responsibility towards the very people that I'm competing with for the patronage from the general public. Now, there is a very famous story about the Chafetz Chaim. The Chafetz Chaim was the great 20th century sage in Radin. And in his youth, he opened a dry goods store that was primarily managed by his wife. And both because the Chafetz Chaim was a very unusual tzaddik and because he was scrupulously honest in his business, he tended to attract all of the business in the town, and people stopped going to the other competitors. As a result, he only opened his store for a very limited number of hours a day, just enough to make enough food for that day, and then he closed his store down immediately in order to give business to other people. What eventually happened was that people were forming lines for those 1 or 2 hours a day just to go to the Chafetz Chaim store, and he finally left the dry good business totally. He closed down the store. He said, I am not going to operate my business at the expense of other people, and that is when he reluctantly earned his living by selling his Sforim, which of course he sold them anonymously for many years, not even telling people that he was the author of the books that he was selling. Now that, of course, is what we call a Midas Chasidus. That is going beyond the letter of the law. Certainly that is not what the Torah requires of us. There is a Mishnah above Mitzvah, and if you recall, when Dr. Chamari was here as a scholar in residence a few months ago, I believe he did discuss this Mishnah. The Mishnah above Mitzvah records an argument between Rav Yehuda and the Chachamim, that Rav Yehuda says a storekeeper, in an attempt to attract business, should not distribute to children sweets and raisins in order to encourage their parents to patronize the store, because that would be taking business away from other people. Similarly, Rav Yehuda says, and this is quite surprising, a storekeeper should not lower his prices in an attempt to attract business, because that also will take people away from the other stores. However, the Chachamim, the sages, which is the majority opinion, disagree with Rav Yehuda on both points. They say there is nothing wrong with making efforts to attract customers who would otherwise go to another store if the public feels your services are superior. And the language that the Chachamim say is, after all, if storekeeper number one is attracting the customers through giving raisins and sweets, then the other person can give fruits and nuts. The point is that provided all people are playing on the same level field, the fact that I do something to attract patronage is not considered unfair competition if the other entity has the same option of matching whatever I'm doing. The same thing is true with prices. So on its face, therefore, the Mishnah is taking the position that there is nothing morally offensive about the notion of competition per se, and moreover, competition can in fact be beneficial to the general public, and there's nothing wrong with that. However, the Rishonim see in the Chachamim's response a certain implication that some forms of competition are considered to be unfair. Because note what the Chachamim say. The Chachamim say, the reason it is permissible for me to lower my prices, or the reason it's permissible for me to offer promotional gimmicks, is because that same option is open to the other person, and ultimately the public is served. That seems to suggest that for me to engage in certain competitive tactics that the other side would be economically unable to match might in fact constitute some form of unfair competition. Now, an example that is given by the Rishonim of a practice that is unfair competition and that a rabbinic court would be entitled to enjoin, again, let me just say as an aside that unfortunately we live in a society where halakha is not going to be enforced either in a secular court, nor do we even have the rabbinic courts that have the power to enforce these norms. So as far as we're concerned today, these are basically non-enforceable halakhas. That, however, does not detract from their mandatory status. Even if there is no court that can enforce an aspect of Jewish law, an Orthodox Jew, a Torah-believing Jew, would still be bound by the directive. In either event, the case that is given is the following. Let's assume that we have a store that is located at the end of a dead-end street. It's located at the end of an alley. So you cannot approach it from one side, you can only approach it from another side. And I, as a competitor, decide to open up a store selling the same product, and I locate it at the part of the street that is closest to the intersection. Which means any single customer that would try to go to that store at the end would have to pass my store first. So the Mordechai brings an opinion that says this would be unfair competition, because essentially any customer that would be trying to get there would have to go by your store first. Now if it's on a main street which is open on both sides, so if I position my store at one intersection and you position your store at another intersection, so I'll get the people that come from one end and you'll get the people that will come from the other end, so we're basically both on equal footing. If, however, your store is positioned where invariably people are going to go to me, so in the language of the Mordechai, this is not simply competition. This is what we regard as destructive competition. This is competition which is designed essentially to obliterate the person's expectancy to get patronage from the general public, and that might be something, that might be a practice that a Jewish court would enjoin. The notion of destructive competition that the other person could not match. Another example, the Ramah says, is price cutting. Excessive price cutting that is beyond the capability of a competitor might be enjoined in accordance with Jewish law. I think a very classic example would be, let's assume that a neighborhood is serviced by a small ma-and-pa grocery, and Giants decides to open up a big chain in the same neighborhood, and because Giants is a chain that has many hundreds of stores, they can buy things in bulk and in great quantities, and they can undersell the ma-and-pa grocery. Now, the ma-and-pa grocery would not be able to charge the same prices as the chain, because essentially they would be selling below their cost, quite possibly, or at least they wouldn't have a livable margin of profit. Well, I don't know if Mr. Danzansky would respond to a Din Torah. I don't know if he's alive anymore. But the point is that there would be a serious halachic question whether one is permitted to open a chain store in an area that is serviced by a ma-and-pa, simply because that would have a destructive impact on the ma-and-pa, unless... and again, this would have to be determined on a case-by-case basis, unless the ma-and-pa store has a special selling point over and above their price, which would allow them to continue to get reasonable patronage. If, for example, the Giants would not offer certain services that are offered by the smaller store, that might be a permissible concession that would permit the large chain store to operate. Again, it's a strange notion, and it's somewhat difficult to understand, because one can argue, after all, if the chain store sells goods at a lower price, isn't it beneficial to the public to have them there? Well, there are really two responses for that. One response is, well, it might be beneficial to the public, but the halakha also takes into account the fact that people who are in competitive lines of business are also entitled to legal protection. And the second theory would be that ultimately maintaining some type of competitive presence would be beneficial to the public in the long run, by avoiding the creation of a quasi-monopolistic situation. But whatever the theory, the halacha does maintain a kind of counterintuitive notion that one is obligated to look out for the person that you're competing against. Another example of unfair competition relates to a concept that is called in the Gemara, Ani Hamahapech B'Charora. Ani Hamahapech B'Charora means a poor man that is looking at a cake. And this is kind of a generic term for a type of case. The case is this. Imagine the poor man that is walking by a bakery, and he's hungry, he hasn't eaten in 2 days, and he's looking at this delicious bagel. He has enough money for a bagel, 25 cents for a bagel. He doesn't have enough money for anything else. There's only one bagel in the window. And he's looking at the bagel longingly, and he's counting out his change. And you, after eating a full breakfast, decide you like a bagel. You walk in, and you plunk down your quarter, and you take the bagel away. So the Gemara says as follows. The Ani, the poor man who is eyeing the cake that you take away from him, legally he has no recourse, because after all, if there was no contract here, he didn't own it yet, you are within your legal rights to divert that opportunity from him, that benefit from him, but nevertheless, Nikra Rasha, one is called morally an evil person. It is evil, in other words, to take away something that somebody had an expectation of trying to get. And the Gemara and the Rishonim in particular generalized that this goes beyond the narrow situation of the poor man who's eyeing the bakery. And this is a general notion that once someone has a legitimate expectation, a reasonable expectation of obtaining a certain economic opportunity, it is considered to be immoral, although not illegal, to divert that opportunity away from him. Now, of course, when you come to particular case-by-case basis, it's very difficult to determine at what point an expectation becomes legitimate. Certainly, for example, if there's a contract, those of you who are lawyers know that there is a tort that is called inducing a breach of contract. Certainly, if I have a contract with you and somebody induces you to break it, that is a violation of this principle, if not even more than that. But the Mefarshim make it very clear that we're not simply talking about taking away a contractual right from somebody.
But we are talking about expectations that rise to less than formal or enforceable contracts. For example, if somebody is entering very serious negotiations about buying a house, and you are aware of that, even if a contract has not yet been signed, for you to submit another bid raises some very serious moral issues in the category of ani hamahapech b'charora. Now, I'm not saying that for sure it's going to be forbidden. It's a very technical area. How far have negotiations progressed would be a very key determinant here. Has there been, have various details been finalized? But at some point in the game, when an expectation has been fairly concretized, that is when this principle kicks in. Now, the Shulchan Aruch makes clear that diversion of general competition alone is not considered taking away an expectancy. In other words, if one has one store servicing an area and I open another store, although there'll be some loss of business, that is not considered taking away some expectancy, because there is no general expectancy to get unlimited income from the public at large. However, consider this. Let's assume I'm starting a new business in the area. And what I'm doing is I am targeting specific promotional efforts towards that other store's clientele. Okay, the grocery store wouldn't be that example, but let's assume that we have two clothing stores in the area, and I obtain a mailing list of one of the stores, and I make a special mailing that is specifically targeted not at the public at large, but specifically at the people who patronize that first store. And one could even posit, I give them a special offer, which I don't make available to the public at large. I want to get their business. I want them to leave the firm they're patronizing. That is, that may be a violation of this principle of diverting anticipated expectancies away from someone who already had kind of a prior, at least moral, if not legal, claim against them. In fact, and again, I want to emphasize, I'm going to raise more questions than answers tonight, and these are just things that people can think about. Let's consider the very common practice when people leave professional firms. I know lawyers always do this, accountants and the like. And they take with them, they send out a lot of cards to all of the firm's clients saying that they're leaving. And moreover, if they were associates who were working on cases or if they were partners, they take a lot of the customers with them. Now, granted, there's no breach of contract involved because these relationships are normally terminable. But are we dealing with a moral problem of diverting expected gains from the firm? I don't have a definite answer on that, because one can argue that a given client owes much more allegiance to a particular lawyer, perhaps, than to a firm. So in fact, one can say, well, the client was never really employing the firm as such. The client was employing the lawyer, and going with the lawyer is therefore not a diversion. And yet, the way the relationship is structured, it is certainly a relationship with a firm and not with a particular attorney. So one can question whether you have that problem again of the ani hamahapech b'charora. Again, even if we have a base, then these are not legally enforceable norms, but these are certain moral values that halakha implicates. Do not take away the gain that one rightfully has and believes that there's an expectation for. Okay. So that is one issue. We've talked about the idea of competition, destructive competition, targeting promotional efforts against a particular group of customers. These are within the general category that is called hasagas gvul, infringing on somebody else's boundary. Let me mention one point, that the halakha does recognize that there is one area where competition is to be encouraged at all costs, and that is in the building of yeshivas. Generally speaking, the Gemara says that the more yeshivos there are, the better it is, because we have a saying, kinas sofrim, competition among educational institutions and learning will cause a greater growth in wisdom and learning. So consequently, although there are cases where sometimes multiple yeshivas have been enjoined in the past, but as a general presumption, this type of proliferation is to be encouraged rather than discouraged, as a sign of the internal moral strength of a community, that it should be able to support different institutions. Okay, let me mention one other point about our relationship to competitors, and that is product disparagement, which triggers the idea of Lashon Hara. You know, when I was growing up, and I'm sure all of you remember better than me, the old advertisements never used to mention competitors. They always had brand X, you know, this detergent is better than brand X, and they have some wrapping over the competitive product. And today, however, for various reasons, it is very common for commercials to engage in competitive evaluation of products. The Pepsi Challenge is a very good example. And sometimes when you watch some of the commercials, it takes a while to even know what product is being advertised, because they show you so many different things, and you're not really sure what they're talking about, which is indeed a fairly serious marketing problem. But the issue is this. The issue is that once you are dealing with comparing your product against another product, whether it is done in mass media advertising or whether it's even done in a face-to-face communication, I simply tell you, don't buy that, it's a piece of junk, you immediately become implicated in a very serious, or the possibility of a very serious prohibition. And that very serious prohibition is Lashon Hara. Now, what is Lashon Hara? Lashon Hara is basically engaging in a derogatory communication about someone or something. Let me emphasize, the prohibition of Lashon Hara does not refer to something being untrue. If it's untrue, there's a separate aveira. That's the aveira of lying. The Torah prohibits untruth. Lashon Hara is bedafka where it is true. So on its face, we start off with a presumption that derogatory communications are forbidden unless there is a halachic justification for permitting them. And we have to examine, well, what will be the halachic justifications for disparagement of a competitor's product? Well, here, we are very lucky. Judaism is unique, really, I think, in all world religions. We have an entire book written on the laws of permissible gossip. When are you permitted to say something nasty about somebody else? And indeed, this is written by the famous Chafetz Chaim, who I mentioned before, the famous sage of Radin. This was the first book that he wrote at the age of 35. And by the way, he's called Chafetz Chaim, which means the man who loves life, who wants life, because of the verse in Psalms that says, who is the man who loves life? He who watches his tongue from speaking evil. And he wrote this book to combat Lashon Hara. It was said that somebody once asked the Chafetz Chaim, you know, why do you write these books? You're making life so hard for people. And the Chafetz Chaim's response was, what do you mean? If I didn't write the book when you're allowed to say Lashon Hara, you wouldn't be allowed to talk at all. I created a situation where you're at least allowed to say something. And if I could digress for a moment, I just want to say that the fact that we have a book about the laws of gossip tells us something very significant about Torah Judaism generally. And that is, you know, people raise the question, why is the Torah, why are the Orthodox so preoccupied with details? We talk about this detail, that detail, how much can you wash your hands here? On Shabbos, how do you take the skin off the chicken off the skin? Why don't we talk about the important things of life, like love and compassion and faith? Why do we deal with details? And the answer is really very simple. Because it's very easy to talk about generalities if you're not given any concrete guidance or direction as how to apply them. And the point is, we have an infinite capacity for deceiving ourselves. We have an infinite capacity to rationalize what we're doing and saying, sure, I love my neighbor, and I'm doing this for the good reasons and not ulterior motives and the like. And the halacha takes into account our weaknesses. And the halacha knows that human beings are capable of justifying almost everything from a core of some general, vague, nebulous standards. And therefore, the whole predicate of halacha is that we need very specific guidance as to what we can do. And unless we can translate general ethical judgments into specific directives, those general ethical judgments are not going to get us very far. Because you really do not get that much guidance from general statements. And in fact, in ethics, generally, there's not too much disagreement about the generalities. Everybody knows it's good to be nice, it's good to be kind, it's not good to say bad things unless there's a reason. But the question then becomes, what's the reason? What's the justification? We can make up all sorts of things. And therefore, the Chafetz Chaim lays down with some particularity, what are the justifications? Specifically, in his sefer, there are a list. Now, he's not dealing with mass media advertising because there really wasn't that phenomenon in around 1898 when he wrote the book. But he's dealing with face-to-face communications. Shmero buys a suit from Barrow the tailor, and I'm also a tailor, and I tell him that's a piece of junk, why don't you buy it from me? What are the guidelines which allows me to disparage my competitor's product? And the Chafetz Chaim lays down the following guidelines. Number one, we're dealing with the balancing act here. It is absolutely clear that you are allowed to communicate Lashon Hara to prevent somebody from suffering physical, financial, or emotional loss. And in fact, not only is it permissible to do so, but it's mandatory. The classic example is, you know, the day after Rosh Hashanah, we have the fast of Gedaliah. It's a fast. Gedaliah was a governor of Israel who was killed. The reason he was killed was he was warned about an assassination attempt on his life, and he refused to accept it because he doesn't listen to Lashon Hara. You know, you go over to somebody and say, somebody's out to kill you, at that point you listen to the Lashon Hara. And similarly, you're allowed to give the Lashon Hara, right? So we do start off with this notion that certainly you're allowed to communicate Lashon Hara to save somebody from physical, financial, or emotional loss. Somebody wants to enter a partnership with someone who you know is an embezzler, you have to tell the person, this is an embezzler, do not enter into business with him. So, we're balancing this Lashon Hara prohibition against the affirmative obligation to look out for somebody's welfare, and we emerge with the following guidelines. If you know that somebody has entered into a business transaction that will be injurious to him, if you know it's true, and you don't exaggerate, if you know, for example, of one instance where somebody got cheated, you can tell him, you know, I know of one time when the person got cheated. You cannot overgeneralize and say, he's a cheat. You have to limit it to what you actually know. And if you know it secondhand, you can still report it, but you have to report it as hearsay. You have to say, I have heard from people that this is it. And then the Chafetz Chaim adds another condition, which is very interesting. You are allowed to communicate the defective nature of the product only if you feel that your words are going to make a difference. In other words, if by telling him that the goods are inferior, that will allow him to terminate the transaction and go and buy it elsewhere, that is permitted. If, on the other hand, he's going to go through with it anyway, then the only thing you've generated is bad will on his part. In other words, he's going to look askance at his seller, but it's not going to culminate in any type of self-protection. Then it's no longer permitted. Now, of course, if, as a result of telling him that the goods are shoddy, he will not deal with this person in the future, that's permissible as well. In other words, you can either avoid this transaction or avoid dealing with the person in the future. But otherwise, if your words are not going to save him that economic expense, it is normally going to be prohibited to tell him this. Finally, the Chafetz Chaim says, your intention in your communication must be exclusively altruistic. It must be for the benefit of the person to whom the communication is made. And I dare say that a competitor in an advertising campaign is normally not in the position to be able to make altruistic judgments. The competitor is not doing it to save you from engaging in a transaction that would be shoddy and the like. Now the Chafetz Chaim even goes further than a lot of technicalities, and that is he differentiates between pre-transaction communications and post-transaction communications. Pre-transaction communications, your communication can have the effect of avoiding the sale. But once the sale has been consummated, if there is, under substantive Jewish law, no rescissionary right, then again, your statement serves no justifiable purpose, except insofar as it may preclude doing business in the future. And the Chafetz Chaim concludes, unless future business is a possibility, it would be prohibited to make that statement. All right, so we have many, many guidelines. I didn't even give you all of them. The point that is to be seen here there is, however, that any type of comparative advertising campaign that draws attention to the defects in a competitor's product does raise a very serious possibility of Lashon Hara. Now, insofar as safety considerations might be concerned, such as, let's say you're aware that a certain car has a dangerous tendency to turn over as you round curves, that would probably be within the heter of informing people about potentially dangerous situations. But insofar as there's no element of danger that's concerned, there might be a problem of Lashon Hara. And again, that would mean, as a practical matter, that the religious copywriter or the religious businessman that is engaging in an advertising campaign should consult his local Orthodox rabbi as to what it is permissible to say and what it is not permissible to say. The safest guideline is stick to the merits of your product instead of talking about the deficiencies in the other product. And you'll have the additional advantage that people will know when they see the commercial what the product is that's being advertised. Okay. So, Bekitzer, we've identified in the area of competition the notion of destructive competition, the notion of diverting expectations through targeting particular customers, and the very serious problem of false advertising, not false advertising, we're talking about true advertising, that involves disparagement of competing products. False advertising certainly has no justification whatsoever, but even true advertising implicates this prohibition of Lashon Hara. Coming to the second relationship, we're now talking about customers. What are my responsibilities to my customers? Whether I am a vendor of goods or whether I am a vendor of services, lawyer, doctor, accountants. Well, first, there's a very interesting pasuk in the Torah that says, "Lifnei iver lo sitein michshol." In front of a blind person, do not place a stumbling block. What does that pasuk mean? Well, it does mean what it literally says. Don't trip somebody that's blind. But Rashi says it means more than that. Rashi says it is prohibited to give somebody what is called an eitzah she'eina hogenes lo, to give somebody a piece of counsel or advice that is injurious to them. An amazing idea. You are not allowed to give somebody advice, to urge them to take a course of action that is injurious to them. This is amazing. This runs to a large extent counter to the whole modern philosophy of advertising. The whole modern philosophy of advertising is to create within the consumer a desire and a need for certain things that are in fact not necessary. According to Jewish law, it is prohibited for a seller to urge a customer to purchase something that in the seller's own judgment the customer does not really need. I know in my case, I remember when I was in law school, encyclopedia salesmen are notorious examples for that. I don't want to go into the whole story, but for some reason I basically became committed to buying an encyclopedia that I did not need at the time. And there are cases in the legal system of illiterate people buying encyclopedias and sets of books that they would never really need. They simply sign and the person tells them, well, it's only 10 cents a day for the next 1,000 years. Not a big deal. People buy various insurance policies. There's a lot of high-pressure salesmanship in the world that induces within people a sense that they need things when they don't really need things. Even the easy availability of credit. One can argue that sending people credit cards, and particularly after bankruptcy, again, this is a phenomenon. I'll say this is a very important piece of knowledge. When a person has gone through a bankruptcy, one cannot get a discharge again for 6 years. That means, in effect, after you've gone out of a bankruptcy, you are a very safe credit risk. You have no way of escape for 6 years. Consequently, the ironic situation is that after a bankruptcy, people very often do get swamped with credit cards. Again, this is clearly a violation of Eitzah She'eina Hogenes Lo. You're giving somebody poison. You're giving the alcoholic drink to the alcoholic. And a seller has a responsibility not to tell people, not to urge people to buy things they don't need, and perhaps, although this is a little less questionable, or more questionable, there might even be an affirmative obligation to steer people away. Now, I have seen in my lifetime sellers who have actually told people, you shouldn't get this, this is not for you. And that's very exemplary moral conduct, but that's certainly not common in the business world or the professional world. But that's the Eitzah She'eina Hogenes Lo. You have to look out for what that person needs. And even if that's at the expense of your own profit margin, you are obligated to make that commitment to that person. What about price regulation? Is there any restriction on the prices or the profits that I can make in my business? Well, here we have some very interesting ideas. And there is in the Gemara in Bava Basra a category of commodities that are called chaye nefesh. Chaye nefesh are commodities that are considered to be the staples of life. This normally would include food and basic clothing and the like. And here, the Gemara does say that for basic commodities of life, a profit margin is normally not permitted that is in excess of 1/6 above cost. So if, for example,
the cost to the ultimate retailer was $5, the retailer can charge $6, because then he's making a 1/6 on the total price of profit. Now, there's some question whether this category of chayei nefesh applies today. Now, again, I want to emphasize, this is a limitation on profit only in the event of necessities of life. It does not apply to luxury items, it does not apply to cars, it does not apply to real estate. It does apply to food. Now, there's some question whether this chayei nefesh is applicable only in Eretz Yisrael, or even in Chutz Loretz. Also, the poskim emphasize that the practical implementation of chayei nefesh can apply only when there is a rabbinical court that has jurisdiction over all competitors. In other words, if there are some people who are beyond the pale of the Beis Din and they charge excessive prices, then you're allowed to charge excessive prices as well. So consequently, realistically, it cannot really be employed today. But there is certainly a very strong teaching in our Chazal that people should not make excessive profits off the necessities of life. I want to emphasize, too, that in the later literature we find that the chachamim of a particular locale have jurisdiction to institute coercive measures to keep profits down for necessities. We find, for example, boycotts mentioned in the Gemara when people were charging too much money for fish on Shabbos. And it is recorded that the rabbis paskin that nobody should buy any fish on Shabbos to lower the demand, thereby causing the prices to go down. We find even on ritual items, there was a very high cost, the Gemara in Sukkah records, of hadassim and aravos. Interestingly, today, you know, esrog is the big item. But in the Gemara's time, at various times, it was hadassim and aravos that were very expensive. And one of the rabbis said, okay, he paskin like an opinion that permitted you to use broken off branches, which is only a single opinion, he permitted that, and as a result, those were so readily available that the prices plummeted down. So there is very strong precedent in halakhic literature for the use of rabbinically sanctioned economic boycotts to keep the price of necessities down. In Baltimore, where I came from, you may be familiar with the fact that for a number of years, although I think they're abandoning it finally, but for a number of years, there was a takana in the Baltimore rabbinate that nobody could sell or buy a lulav or an esrog for more than $30 to $40. It went up over the years, and that kept down. There was an artificial price ceiling on the price of a lulav and an esrog. Now, I always had some suspicion that as a result, Baltimore was not getting the best lulavs and esrogs. And I believe that was confirmed, because I understand they're abrogating the takana. But nevertheless, there is a notion for halakhically sanctioned boycott when prices are excessive, and this is something that, I don't want to cause too much trouble tonight, but this is something that we can sometimes think about as Pesach approaches, or other Yom Tovim approaches. But this, of course, requires the consent of all the rabbinic leadership of a given community, which in itself is often very difficult to obtain. Again, I want to emphasize that we're talking about price control for the so-called necessities of life. Luxury items per se are not subject to price controls, because after all, you want to spend $1 million for your boat, that's your business, we have no reason to protect you by keeping prices down. There is one form of price control, however, that applies across the board, but that's fairly rare. And that is the din of onah. Onah refers to cheating in price. And you may recall, those of you that are familiar with the Gemara, that also talks about 1/6. You cannot charge 1/6 or more. But I want to, it should be emphasized at the outset that onah is not really a limitation on profit. Because the 1/6 is not calculated as 1/6 over your cost, but rather the 1/6 means you cannot charge 1/6 or more over what is called a prevailing market price. Which means to say, if you have a consortium of sellers who are selling things at a 300% markup, you are perfectly within your halakhic rights, subject to the chayei nefesh rule, to sell things at a 300% markup. As long as you don't exceed the profit margin, exceed that prevailing market price by 1/6 or more. Okay? So consequently, in a normal competitive market, onah is not going to be that important, because number one, how do you define a prevailing market price when people are always selling things at slightly different prices? Do you determine an average? It's not really clear. Well, you don't have a single standardized price. And in any event, in a competitive market, from the highest price to the lowest price, there will tend not to be a major discrepancy. And therefore, most prices that are charged are within the ONAR limitations. Because remember, ONAR is not a limitation on profit. It simply limits going beyond a prevailing market price, which in itself may include a substantial markup in the form of profit. Okay. The final aspect of our relationship with customers I want to discuss is something that is called Gnevas Das. Gnevas Das literally means theft of the mind. And this refers to misrepresentation. And here we get into the whole area of false advertising. We get into the area of deceptive salesmanship. We get into the area of bait and switch. You know, bait and switch is a practice where they advertise one product to get you in. Let's say they say, for example, they're selling a TV for, you know, TVs, black and white TVs for $50. They don't tell you there's only one available, and you get, that gets you to the store. And once they get you to the store, they try to give you something else. That's called bait and switch. Now, let me give you a few examples from the Talmud about the principle of Gnevas Das, and then we'll see how they apply to many, many modern methods of salesmanship. There is a story in the Gemara about two rabbis that were taking a walk. And as they were taking a walk, they met a third rabbi that was coming to visit them. So the third rabbi was very impressed. He thought these two rabbis were coming out to meet him. So the third rabbi said, "Oh, I feel so honored that you've come out to meet me." And the younger of the two said, "Well, wait a second, we were just taking a walk." And the other person nudged him, etc. But the Talmud concludes that since there was a misrepresentation here, since the person thought that they were coming out to honor him and they were not, there was an obligation to correct that misapprehension, even at the expense of a potential social nicety. Another example the Gemara gives is a certain person came to someone's house to eat, and the people, not knowing that this person was coming, had broken out a bottle of expensive wine. Let's say you bring out the champagne. And the guest thinks the champagne was brought out for him. But it wasn't. You were drinking it anyway. So the halacha is you have to tell the person, "Well, granted, we would have liked to bring out the champagne for you, but we were bringing it out anyway." Because this is called Gnevas Das, deception. And just like you cannot steal somebody's money, you cannot steal somebody's mind. You cannot deceive. You cannot lie. You cannot even allow a misrepresentation to remain uncorrected. A final example the Talmud Yushalmi gives, that we know the Torah says if a man kills accidentally, he goes to the city of refuge. That's an exile. That's a punishment. And if he goes to the city of refuge and he is welcomed as a great scholar, they think he's just a visitor to the city, he's obligated to tell them, "No, I am here because I committed a crime." And the Gemara even says a Talmud Chacham who only knows one Gemara and people praise him for knowing two Gemaras, he has to tell them, "I only know one Gemara." And in fact, if you read about the works of people like Chafetz Chaim and the like, they're constantly writing. You know, people think, "Oh, I'm a Talmud Chacham and this and that. I have to tell people I only know a few things." Of course, that itself was probably not true, but in their modesty, they believed that it was. Now, what Gnevas Das means is here, of course, any deceptive advertising, by definition, is Gnevas Das. Bait and switch techniques would involve Gnevas Das. But I think there's something more than that. And that is, we see from these examples in the Talmud that Gnevas Das is not only overt misrepresentation. Gnevas Das can also be by omission, a failure to correct somebody's misunderstanding is also Gnevas Das. And indeed, the Rama says in the Shulchan Aruch that if you sell somebody an object and you are aware of certain defects in the object that are not ascertainable by the other person, you have to tell him. Right? You're selling your car. And you know that when you go more than 50 miles an hour, the car gets shaky or the transmission tends to go. And even if it's not a major safety factor, which that would be another consideration, according to the halakha, you are obligated to do so. It's not just a question of lying. It's not just a question of misrepresentation. You are affirmatively obligated to disclose the defects that you are aware of. Now again, the Rambam makes the following point. The Rambam makes the point that we are talking about what is called a latent defect. By a latent defect, I mean a defect that the other person would normally be unable to determine at the juncture of sale. If it's something that he should be able to see, you do not have to point it out to him. In other words, if you're dealing with a person who is not taking the precautions that he is able to take, even if you know that he's not, the Rambam says, that's the hefsed, that is the loss of the buyer, because the buyer should beware of what is something that is easily ascertainable. And again, these are very difficult questions of fact. Let's assume, for example, that you give the person the option to take a test drive around the block. And if he would take a test drive around the block, he would have been able to find out certain things. But he decides not to take the option. Can you take a sigh of relief and say, oh, I'm really glad he didn't do that? Or do you have to tell him what he would have found out? The Rambam seems to say you don't have to tell him, but again, I'm not giving a definitive ruling on that. But certainly, if it's a type of thing which he wouldn't be able to find out until later, you are mechuyav al pi din to tell him. Moreover, the halakha even gives us post-transaction remedies. The halakha says that if somebody purchases something and discovers a defect which was not communicated to him at the time of the sale, he is entitled to rescind the transaction and get his money back, and that is called mekach tos, that is a sale under a mistaken impression. And, you know, we say in the American legal system, the norm for many years was caveat emptor, let the buyer beware, that as long as the seller didn't say anything false, the buyer was stuck with what he got. The trend in American law has been to impose notions of implied warranties and various protections. And I would just make the point that the halakha recognized a notion of implied warranty very many years before the common law came to that type of development. The implied warranty basically is the obligation of the seller to disclose any defects that are known to the seller. Not only is it a violation of religious law, the prohibition of genevas das, but it also gives the seller civil restitutionary rights, permitting him to cancel the transaction, and when there was a base, then he could actually sue for a refund of his money. And also, it doesn't make a difference how insignificant the deviation was. Even a relatively minor deviation would be the basis for a rescissionary action. Let me make one more point about the genevas das idea here, and that is, there is a very close relationship between deception and actual theft. They're not really two separate prohibitions. If I consummate a sale through a misrepresentation, not only have I transgressed genevas das, but by obtaining his money through a false pretense, I am actually committing the sin of theft of his money as well. This also applies even to a non-Jew. The Gemara in Chulin is absolutely clear that it is forbidden to engage in misrepresentation or deception, even with respect to a non-Jew. And this would apply, among other things, to cheating in tests. Probably not in Silver Spring. We're a bit more enlightened than some communities. But occasionally you will come across the notion, the erroneous notion, that it is permitted for yeshiva students to cheat in English tests. Because, you know, it's only English. And while acknowledging that English is only English, not Limudei Kodesh, but it's certainly clear that any type of cheating invariably involves genevas das. There is tacit misrepresentation, there is deception, insofar as you're taking the test. The Gemara says specifically that genevas das is usur, even with respect to a non-Jew, and cheating in tests would therefore be forbidden simply because of that, if nothing else. Moreover, if you consider this, when somebody, let's say somebody cheats on a professional licensing exam, if you cheat on the bar exam and you're employed as a lawyer, essentially every single fee that you collect for the duration of your career is being received under a false pretense, because people are giving you money because they think you're licensed by the state to practice law, where in fact you would not have been licensed based on what you're doing. So essentially your whole life is one perpetual act of theft. How does one do tshuva? I don't know. Let's say after 50 years of practicing law, you want to do tshuva that you cheated on the bar exam. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is very compassionate.
But however, if you go to the bar examiners and say that you've cheated on your bar exam, they are not likely to forgive you and allow you to continue practicing. How would one do tshuva? I don't know. And how far does that go back? Let's say you cheated in a college exam, and as a result you passed calculus, and that allowed you to go to law school. Does that mean that the whole legal education is a product of Nevis Das? These days, people start applying to college when they're in nursery. You know, who knows? The point is that many averos have a ripple effect. There is a ripple effect that locks us into a pattern of continuous misrepresentation. Once a lie is made, we all are familiar with that. When you lie, you're forced to continue lying in one form or another. And there's a very close relationship. It's not just misrepresentation, but it easily shades into theft and in geneva and all sorts of other averos as well. Let me mention one area of halacha regarding your relationship to customers that is considered to be perhaps the most complicated area of halacha in the whole Shulchan Aruch. And that is, there's a prohibition in the Torah against charging interest. Very interesting. If you lend somebody money, you're not allowed to charge them interest. You can get your principal back, you can't get interest. Now this, unlike some other things, only applies between a Jew and a Jew. So thus, you're allowed to have money in a bank that is owned by non-Jews, and you can get interest there. You can lend money to a non-Jew. That's why Jews had a reputation in the Middle Ages as being money lenders, and indeed they were, but simply because Christian Europe didn't let them do anything else. And according to halacha, you are allowed to lend money with interest to a non-Jew, but to a Jew you can't. Now, there are a lot of common pricing mechanisms that involve interest. Let's assume, for example, you're a wholesaler. You're a Jewish wholesaler, and you sell to a retail store, and you have some type of pricing term that says, gives them a cash discount. You say, for example, if you pay now or you pay within a month, I'll charge you one price. And if you pay after 30 days, I'm going to charge you more than that. Now, you can call that two things. You can either say, the price for this is $100. After 30 days, there'll be a finance charge of 1% a month. That's clearly interest, because essentially, you're charging them money for a delay. But let's say, semantically, you change it around, and you simply say that the price is $110, but I'm giving a 5% discount for early payment. That doesn't make a difference. It doesn't make a difference if you say the price is X, I'm going to charge extra for late payment, or you say the price is the larger figure and I'm going to give you a cash discount. Anytime there is a differential between a credit term and a cash term, or any time the price that you pay varies with the amount of time that you're holding on to the money, that involves a prohibition of ribis. That involves a problem of interest. And if it's between two Jewish people, that transaction would be forbidden unless it's structured in a permissible way. So the cash discount raises an interest problem. Let me mention a second problem. Prepayment. Very common. Let's assume your son is about to become bar mitzvah, and you want to buy a pair of tefillin for your son. Now, there's a backlog. Let's say you give money to a sofer, and very often it may take a year or so till you can get the best tefillin. Today, I think the best pair of tefillin are probably close to $1,000, if not more than that. So what you do is, you put down $1,000, and you stipulate for a future delivery date, let's assume, in a year or so. Why do you give the money in advance? Because in a sense, what you're doing is, you're prepaying for a guaranteed price. So even if tefillin are worth $2,000 a year from now, you're guaranteeing delivery at that price. Well, that's considered to be interest. If you put down $1,000, and you stipulate for the future delivery of a commodity, so essentially, between the date of your advance and the date of delivery, you have advanced, you have extended credit, you have lent your funds to the merchant. And if the merchant has borrowed $1,000, and he's going to deliver to you a commodity in the future that is worth $1,500 or $2,000, in a sense, he is paying you interest for the use of your funds for that entire year period. And therefore, the halacha is very clear that it is normally prohibited to prepay for a commodity in advance to be delivered at a future date unless there was some inventory available on the date of the advance that could have been substituted. Which means to say, if the sofer has some tefillin on the shelf, so in a sense, you could have gotten the tefillin right away. It could have been a contemporaneous exchange rather than a credit transaction. So even if later you decide to defer delivery for various reasons, that would be permissible. But to the extent there is no inventory there, that would be forbidden because that is considered to be an interest transaction. Again, this is a common example for appliances, especially in Israel, for cars, for tefillin. In fact, it would even be a problem in buying a bus ticket or something of that nature, where essentially you're buying something at a discount. Well, bus ticket would not be a problem because that's a simultaneous exchange. But whenever it's a credit transaction for future delivery, you're dealing with usury. A third example, a seller-financed mortgage. This is a very simple example. If you're buying a house from a seller who is Jewish, and it is a seller-financed mortgage where you're going to owe money to the seller and you sign a promissory note and you agree to pay principal and interest to the seller as opposed to a lending institution, if that seller is Jewish, consult your rabbi at the first opportunity. There are ways this can be arranged. I don't want to go into all the technicalities, but on its face, that transaction is a violation of halacha. Now, if a lending institution has taken the mortgage, there is no problem, of course, because, number one, most banks, contrary to popular opinion, do not have Jewish majority ownership. Jews are not very big in the banking industry. But secondly, Rav Moshe Feinstein makes the point that even if you have a Jewishly owned lending institution, actually other people make the point, since it's a corporate entity, you might be allowed to pay them interest. Actually, Rav Moshe says you can't. Rav Moshe says if it's a majority-owned Jewish bank, you can receive interest from them, but you're not allowed to pay interest. Other poskim might permit that as well. But be it as it may, if you're dealing with an individual seller who is Jewish, there is clearly going to be an interest problem. A final interest problem, again, I'm just throwing out problems. Next block, a competitor, and you ask, can I borrow 10,000 sheets of paper and I will return them to you at a future date? 10,000 sheets for 10,000 sheets. Well, that may involve interest because if the market value of the paper fluctuates between the 2 days, if you borrow 10,000 sheets when they're worth a penny a sheet and you return them when they're worth 2 pennies a sheet, you have, in a sense, repaid more than you have taken, and this is considered to be a prohibition of ribis. And in fact, if you think about interest, interest can involve everything. You borrow a cup of sugar, and you return a cup of sugar the next day. Well, if prices have fluctuated, do we have a problem of interest? Or you return 2 eggs. Do we have to start looking at comparative values? Now, generally, in household transactions, we regard everything as gifts. But when you're dealing with legal obligations between people who are dealing at arm's length, all of these matters do involve interest. I can't hope to address all of the ramifications of the issue of ribis right now, but it is something that I hope people will be aware of. Particularly, someone just told me that they were buying a house with a seller-financed mortgage, and they were literally not aware that there even was a problem. And I hope at least people will now be aware that there is indeed a shaila that has to be addressed. Okay, I'll just try to shorten and just throw out a few more aspects just to think about. There is a halacha in terms of debt collection. There are federal regulations regarding debt collection, and the halacha restricts debt collection as well. There's a law in the Torah of not being an oppressive creditor. Lo CLO kenosha. And that means you're not allowed to apply pressure to a person when you know that person does not have the current ability to pay. I remember attending a convention a few years ago
of law professors. And there was a section on Jewish law, so I thought it'd be interesting. And I was very amazed to find that the main speaker was a Mormon from Brigham Young University. And he was addressing Jewish law. And there was another guy from Touro, a Jewish person. And it's very interesting the way people try to, the grass is always greener on the other side. The Jewish person was trying to show, well, Jewish law is just like secular law, it has the same structure. He was trying to kind of secularize Jewish law. And the Mormon was insistent that Jewish law is transcendent and spiritual and goes beyond the values of secularism. So each one was trying to take the other position. And the Mormon said that when he was reading the book of Deuteronomy, which talks about not oppressing your borrower, don't press people who can't afford it. He had lent somebody money before, and he was really very impatient about getting the money back. But when he read this, he was so moved by the moral sentiment that he sent the person a gift instead and said, I know you can't afford it, so don't worry about it. So we do see that even a non-Jew can certainly be affected by the morality of this law. Now let me emphasize this. Number one, there is absolutely no halakhic requirement that you lend money to a person if you think he's a bad credit risk. You are totally within your rights to evaluate somebody's credit worthiness before you make the loan. Number two, if the person has the ability to pay, you are entitled to invoke all legal remedies to collect your debt, but of course that would require going to a Beis Din first. We are talking about a situation where, number one, you already made the loan. Number two, you know the person cannot currently pay. You're not allowed to send him dunning letters. You're not allowed to give him phone calls. And many people would not even walk by his house, the Gemara records, in order not to embarrass the lender. I'm sorry, the borrower. Lo sia lo kenosha. There are also, by the way, exemptions in halakha, just as we have exemptions in secular law. Certain property cannot be taken away from somebody because that is needed for his rehabilitation. Halakha also contains certain exemptions, property that is needed for basic human needs, property that is needed for his occupation and the like. Again, I don't want to go into all of the details. Unfortunately, these halakhas are not very practiced today because people don't normally use a Beis Din for execution on property. But certainly the halakha does have a very comprehensive debt protection scheme. I don't want to run too long, so I'll try to shorten my remaining remarks. Talking about employees, our relationship to our employees, there isn't too much unique to articulate other than there's a general rule in the Torah prohibiting onas devorim. Onas devorim is verbal abuse. Verbal abuse is different than lashon hara. Lashon hara is saying something derogatory about somebody to somebody else. If I tell Reuven that Shimon is a jerk, I have committed lashon hara. If I tell Shimon that Shimon is a jerk, I have transgressed another rav called onas devorim. And here I think we have to be especially sensitive in our relationships to our co-workers, to our employees, to people who perhaps have not achieved the same level of education or prominence that we may have done, secretaries, office boys, messengers, and the like, that they too are human beings. They are entitled to be treated with respect, with appreciation for what they do. And if we tend to lose our tempers and the like, not only have we transgressed onas devorim, but even worse, very often we have engaged in what is called a chilul Hashem, a desecration of God's name, especially if we are from and we're not in a totally religious environment. And that's something we have to be very, very sensitive for. The Torah also makes explicit that one has to try to pay a person's wages without any delay. If the wages are to be paid weekly, they have to be paid weekly. That tends not to be too much of a problem in a modern payroll, except if you work for certain yeshivas and the like. And in that case, people know what they're getting into. But I think onas devorim and chilul Hashem are the two major considerations to keep in mind in our relationship in our non-Jewish environment. The final thing I want to talk about is our relationship to the government as a whole. And here I just want to make two quickie points. And that is, we do have a principle in halacha that dina de malchusa dina, the law of the governments, is the law. What that means is that I, as a Torah observant Jew, am obligated to obey the law of the government, not because it's the law of the government only, but because it's my religious obligation as a Torah Jew to obey what the government says. Now, obviously, this cannot mean literally what it says, because if that's what it says, as the Rashba points out, what would happen to the Torah? The government says, work on Shabbos, you work on Shabbos. So obviously, this is to be narrowly understood only in the area of mamonos, only in civil law, only with respect to property rights and monetary obligations, not with respect to purely religious law. So we limit dina de malchus adina. Moreover, the Rashba goes further and says that dina de malchus adina governs only the relationship of the person to the government, but not the relationship of one Jew to another Jew. That the relationship of one Jew to another Jew should at all times be governed by Torah law, not by governmental law. It is only my relationship to the government that is governed by this principle. But be it as it may, if we take something, for example, the government has laws regarding taxation, or the government has laws regarding occupational safety or environmental protection, I, as a Torah Jew, am halachically obligated to follow those laws. Income tax evasion is clearly a violation of this principle of dina de malchus adina. That does not mean there's anything wrong with taking advantage of loopholes. People know, of course, a learned hand's famous statement, just paraphrasing, there's no mitzvah to pay taxes. I don't remember exactly how he said it, but he didn't say it that way. He says, you don't have to pay more than the government absolutely requires, and moreover, even if it's a doubtful situation, if there's a reasonable support for your position, you are within your rights to put the burden on the government to find it out and question you about it. Okay? I'm not talking about favorable, lenient interpretations of the tax code. We are talking about, however, tax evasion, fraudulent underreporting of income, and the like. This is clearly a violation of halacha. One transgresses a doraisa if one engages in this type of deception. At the same time, there's another principle here that says if there are any disputes between Jews, these matters have to initially be settled in a Jewish basis. Parshas Mishpatim, Rashi says, these are the Mishpatim, these are the laws that you should place in front of the Jewish court. Rashi says, Lifneihem, in front of the Jewish court, and not in front of the non-Jewish court. And Rashi makes the point, even if the law that the Jewish court is going to apply is non-Jewish law, even if the substantive law is dina de malchus adina, that doesn't make a difference. One has a halachic obligation to bring their dispute in front of a beis din. And one is not committed to go to a non-Jewish court unless the other party either refuses to go to a beis din, or after the beis din has made its decision, he refuses to abide by it, so you can then go to a non-Jewish court and petition for enforcement of the beis din's decision. By the way it normally works is that before parties go to a beis din, they sign an agreement that is tantamount to an agreement to arbitrate, and a decision of a beis din should normally be enforceable as an arbitration award. So you are permitted to go to a secular court to enforce the decision of a beis din, but you must first go to a beis din, or at least summon the other person to go in front of a beis din. This has nothing to do with choice of law. Even if the choice of law is going to be a secular law, through dina de machus adina, you must go to a beis din. Again, bavanaseinu harabim, we don't have an organized communal beis din. The way it normally works is if there are disagreements, we follow the procedure of each litigant choosing a rabbinical judge of their own choosing, and then the two choose a third one. This is called zebora lo echad, zebora lo echad. And it's unfortunately a commonplace in America that if you don't like the decision of the beis din, you just disregard it. But the halacha requires you to listen to the beis din that you've chosen. And you know, God willing, we should all try to resolve our disputes in the way that the Torah requires, rather than resorting to a secular system. In conclusion, we briefly discussed these four relationships. The Gemara in Sanhedrin says that David HaMelech did tzedakah u'mishpat. He did charity and justice among his people. And the Talmud asks, there's a contradiction here. Charity means doing more than the law requires, doing somebody a favor, and mishpat is strict judgment. How can you have tzedakah and mishpah?
And the Gemara answers that when people came in front of David HaMelech and he was a judge, and he paskined that Reuven owes Shimon money, and Reuven paid what Reuven owed, so to Shimon, he did judgment, justice. Shimon got what he deserved. To Reuven, who was able to disgorge a gain that was unjust, he did a favor to Reuven. He gave Reuven charity. We see from the Gemara that although sometimes the Torah requires us to forego gain, to lose some money that we'd be able to do otherwise, we actually regard it as a favor when HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives us the chance to serve God by giving up something that is not rightfully ours. And indeed, there's a story of the Chassam Sofer. Somebody once asked the Chassam Sofer, how come I'm a shochet, and when I bring my cow to the rabbi, and the rabbi says it's treif, so I said, fine, it's treif, I give up the whole cow, I throw it out. And yet, when there's a din Torah, and the rabbi says, I have to pay this person some money, I get very upset. I mean, the cow is worth more than the $5. And the Chassam Sofer said, well, the reason is, when I say the cow is treif, nobody gets it. But when I say you have to pay him $5, not only are you losing, but he's gaining. For him to gain hurts me more than for me to lose. And that's the way it is in the business world. That's the way it is in Dinei Mamonos. The biggest fights erupt about money. In fact, we know the Gemara tells us some people care more about their money than their life. You know the famous Jack Benny story. And yet, if we really have a sense of the unity of the Jewish people, if we really regard ourselves as one soul, as one neshama, then to some extent it should hurt even less, because when money is simply going from A to B, it's going from one pocket to the other pocket, one hand to the other hand. The more we have achdus, the more we have shalom, the more we really consider ourselves to be an Am Echad, the less this is going to bother us, because it all stays within the family. It doesn't bother us so much if it stays within the totality of Klal Yisrael. And I'll say again that as Jews, it's incumbent upon us to be conscious of God and to regulate our lives by God's Torah, not only when we're in shul, not only when we're davening, but even when we're out there in the marketplace in an environment where very often it is dog-eat-dog, where very often the profit motive has become the highest source of morality. And it's precisely in those times, in those dark times, in those difficult times, that if we can persevere and we can stand up for what God wants us to stand up with, we can truly bring sanctification and kedusha into Hashem's world. Amen. Thank you. I know it's late, but I'm willing to take questions.
You specifically said that dealing with interest only applies with the Jew with the Jew.
Yes.
And with misrepresentation applies with the Jew with the non-Jew.
That's correct.
How about the rest of it? Does it apply with the Jew with the Jew?
Well, I'd have to go through it one by one.
Are there differences?
Most of them apply to Jews and non-Jews. The one notable exception is interest. And the reason is that this is all derived from the wording of biblical verses. When the biblical verse talks about achicha, your brother, that is normally a technical term that connotes a Jew. Most of the other prohibitions, like don't steal or don't cheat, the word achicha is not used, therefore it applies even to a non-Jew.
If I understood correctly, you said that you equated the transgression of the prohibition against verbal abuse as chilul Hashem.
Well, I didn't equate them. I said that both things can be involved.
But it seems to me that chilul Hashem may be involved in almost everything that you mentioned. So
that's very true.
Only at this juncture, did you mention chilul Hashem?
Well, okay, it's true. I think chilul Hashem is a bit more pronounced in the case of verbal abuse, because in the case of sharp business practices, although there may very well be a chilul Hashem, people can understand the profit motive involved. To some extent, there's some exculpation or some excusing that. The verbal abuse, people see less of a justification for. But certainly, Chilul Hashem can cut across the board. Chilul Hashem, too, is not just between Jews and non-Jews. It's also the impression you make on Jews who are not up to your standards of Torah observance. Yeah.
Would you say the issue of verbal abuse applies only to non-verbal, like also the non-verbal languages, such as facial expression?
Yes, because the wording of the pasuk is lo sonu isha samiso. One should not abuse the other person. It doesn't say the word dibur. So I would say facial expression would be the same. Would be the same thing. Sure. Probably, technically not. But then you have Chilul Hashem, which would apply to a guy.
In your discussion of reading, if that's into a little impact, a little impact at all, is there not a way out?
Yes, there is. There is. And yeah, well, there certainly is, and that's really it. Perhaps I should have left it for a subject of another talk. Let me say this, that basically there is a document that is called a Heter Iska. And what the Heter Iska does is it structures loans and gives them the characteristic of investment transactions. And by converting a loan into a type of investment transaction where there's a risk factor involved, then it's no longer considered interest, it's simply considered profit on an investment. However, it's important to note that people do this wrong. People think a Heter Iska is like a magical paper that you sign, and if you put up the paper on your, if you nail the paper to your wall, you can do it. It does involve restructuring the transaction somewhat. So there has to be some element of risk that is thrown in there. And the problem is when you're dealing with a seller who's not even religious, he may not be willing to assume those types of risks. Yeah.
Is it permitted to xerox chapters out of a book for Jewish education without getting permission from the author?
Well, that's a very good question. Many people say it is prohibited. The same issue is with tapes. Can you reproduce a tape of a shiur or of something that you buy, a musical tape, to give it to somebody else when you're depriving the author of a potential royalty? Many poskim say it's forbidden. Other poskim say it's permitted. It's kind of an open question. Under secular law, there is a fair use doctrine that permits limited amounts of copying. And one could raise the question whether the principle of Dina de Malchusa Dina would justify the copying to the extent permitted under American law. That's a question, but perhaps that might be one justification. Yeah.
I was wondering how your definition of a non-suffered is one-sixth greater than the market.
Prevailing market, yeah.
If there is a market, my imperfect memory of my last economics would say that that should be immediately self-liquidating.
Yeah.
If you can impose a one-sixth price, consider that there is no market, and presumably you should be able to really want.
Well, it's a very difficult problem. The most sense I can make out of it is that you compute some hypothetical average market, which may not correspond with what any seller is actually selling, and at that point you look at the deviations. But you're correct. Obviously, in that situation, there should be a self-liquidating market automatically. We're talking about the imperfect information situation where some consumer happened to get caught before there was a self-liquidation. Indeed, most poskim are of the opinion that if the consumer knows he's paying more than that 1/6, by definition, he's forfeited his remedy. But you're right, it's very difficult to conceive exactly how you compute that type of market price.
Is there a statement
in the Chazon that the Lord was spoken by three people? Okay, the Chavitz Chaim has a whole chapter, a very, very big chapter in his book on a statement in the Talmud that says Lashon Hara that was said to three people is no longer Lashon Hara. He basically says there are so many conditions that that's basically not true. It's true if you have something like 20, 25 conditions that are met. It would be hard to go into right now. But basically, the theory of that Gemara is that if I said Lashon Hara in front of three people, they already spread it to the whole world anyway. So at that point, I'm not telling anybody anything new. And the Chavitz Chaim says that would normally not be the case. Well, they do. There was a note that there's one bank in Muncie that is majority ownership is Jewish. And somebody sent around a letter that if you're getting a mortgage from that bank, you have to have a Heter Iska. So they've done it. Most banks are not Jewish controlled. Now, Rav Moshe Feinstein makes a distinction that's a little bit difficult. He says You are allowed to receive interest from a bank whose majority shareholders are Jewish. So you can keep your money in the bank and get interest, but you're not allowed to pay interest to such a bank.
I thought that even there is one Jew at the owner.
No, no. Moshe says majority ownership or controlling ownership. No, he discusses it because a corporation is a separate legal entity. So the fact, same thing with Pesach. There's a din that chametz that was owned by a Jew during Pesach, you're not allowed to eat. What about chametz that is owned by a corporation where only one shareholder is Jewish? Unless the Jews have a controlling interest in that corporation, it's not considered to be owned by a Jew.
The corporation is not regarded as Jewish.
Right, right. So it's a separate person. A corporation is a separate legal person. If you have a share of stock, you cannot go into the corporation and take an asset. You own the stock. You don't own the actual...
I have to say, even if it's a corporation, maybe all of them are
Some have said that. Some have said that. There are some poskim that have said that a corporation is a separate entity, even if it's totally owned by Jews. You're allowed to pay interest to it and take interest from it. But Rav Moshe says the ikar is the controlling ownership of the corporation. Well, the Chofetz Chaim has an important chapter on that. Yes. What is the relationship of misrepresentation and Lashon Hara to matchmaking? If Reuven wants to get engaged to Leah, and you know that Leah has a history of emotional problems or some serious physical problems, and you are normally supposed to tell Reuven of that fact, if you're aware of something that would adversely affect the success of the marriage, that should be disclosed. Now, of course, there's a diplomatic way to do it. You should first talk it over with the person about whom you're going to be communicating before you communicate it, and you should urge that person themselves or herself or himself to disclose that fact. But in fact, the Chofetz Chaim basically says that there has to be full disclosure in matters of shidduchim.
You gave a lot of examples where the is more restricted than secular law. A lot of things would be permissible under secular law whatever it allows. Do you know any examples of the reverse? Or do you know any examples where it would be a direct conflict where a lot would say you must do one thing in secular law and say you must do the other in the area of business ethics?
Well, I'm trying to think. Usually those types of conflicts are fairly rare because if anything, the halacha requires you to do more than the law requires, but it's requiring you to do what the law also permits you to do. I can't think offhand of a situation of an absolute direct conflict. If there would be a direct conflict, halakha would have to govern. The principle of dina de machus dina does not govern in a conflict with halakha.
What is the halakha position regarding a body, whatever black?
Yeah, that's a good question. There are two areas I just want to bring together. One is the notion of negotiation and bargaining. And the other is the notion of informational advantages in transactions, where we're engaged in buying something and I happen to know that there's oil under your land because I conducted a geological survey. On its face, the idea of negotiation, where you initially hold out for a position that you know you're going to give up later, one could argue would be a form of deception. On the other hand, there is in this area kind of a circular reasoning where if everybody knows that you're bluffing and everybody knows this is not your ultimate position, then to some extent you've negated the deception because people know that those are the rules of the game. So to some extent, the ethical norms become redefined by the ethics of the marketplace. It's a bit paradoxical, but the point is, if everybody knows this is the way business is conducted, so that might be halakhically permissible. With respect to informational advantage, which is really also along the line of the ethics of bargaining, again, if I know something about your property or my property and I don't tell you, I think the key here would be the Rama's distinction between the latent defect and the defect that is ascertainable. Remember, the Rama says, I have a duty of disclosure only with respect to those things that you could not ascertain yourself. With respect to those things that you're able to ascertain yourself, I have no responsibility for your negligence. Well, if we're engaged in a stock purchase or an asset purchase, and I've done my research, and I have determined economic potential here, and the same sources that were available for me were available for you, the halacha would not require me, based on this Ramah, arguably, to disclose the basis of my bargaining position. However, when you're dealing with inside information, which by definition was not accessible to both sides, I would think at that point you're dealing with something that is latent, something that was undiscoverable by the other side, and at that point the halacha would clearly prohibit my dealing on the basis of inside information, because that would be Geneva Stas. That's the distinction I would draw. Now, where things become complicated is, let's assume I obtained my information through open, accessible sources, but through a considerable investment of money. Does the halacha require me, as it were, to give you the benefit of my knowledge that I obtained through a lot of expense? Or does the halacha say, well, since I spent the money, you have a responsibility for spending the same amount of money? That's where things get very difficult. That's where I think perhaps you have the most potentially difficult areas in bargaining, and that is, what does one do with information that one obtains through investment? Does the halacha require an affirmative duty of disclosure under those circumstances? And that would be a very tough situation. If you ever be faced with that, I think there'd be some very difficult soul searching. Yeah.
The original lending money is regarded as a form of charity. Therefore, if it's in my mouth, it's not true, because in those days, the money, they were horses, in other words, mm-hmm. they were very rich people. So maybe you now have a full horse, which is really cool.
Yeah. Well, you're right. The economic justification for the heter iska. The heter iska emerged as loans began to be instruments of commerce rather than simply acts of benevolence. And that is why the heter iska did develop over the years. You're right. If you're lending money to a poor man, you should not use a heter iska to charge interest. That's right. Although you can if you want, but it's much better not to. Any other? Okay, I guess we have refreshments now. Thank you for coming.